Last week, we began the story of this all-important event of the birth of Yaakov, Jacob, who would become, follow me, the first Israelite. That's Jacob, the first Israelite. Let's pause and put this in perspective and watch the progress of the patriarchs. Abraham, who was Jacob's grandfather, began life arguably as pagan. The world at the time of Abraham's birth consisted of only one kind of people, the human race. Other than genealogical and social divisions, all humans were about the same in Jehovah's eyes, the one exception being the line of Ham. One of Noah's three sons was an accursed line with the consequence, however broadly or narrowly it would be carried out, though, is unclear. In the first part of Abraham's life, there was no division of humanity. There was no set apart people. I want to be clear, though, about this accursed line of Ham, or more specifically, one of his sons. This simply meant that there would be some elements of their lives and progress that God would justifiably use in a negative way to bring about his overall plan of redemption. To say that the entire line of Ham, or better, Canaan, is cursed doesn't mean that God hates them. It doesn't mean God abandoned them or counts them as humans of lesser worth than others. Rather, something happened in their early history that the Lord judged as terrible enough that in some way or another, future generations were going to bear the brunt. Well, once God called Abraham to leave his country and his immediate family, then began this process of divine dividing the world into two separately identifiable groups of people, his chosen people and everybody else. The name we give to God's people, the name we find in the Bible, is Hebrews. So when Abraham obeyed God and moved to the land of Canaan, by declaration, did God divide mankind into Hebrews on the one hand, all others on the other. Decisions by Abraham and a declaration by God were the sole factors and making Abraham different in God's eyes from all other human beings. Isaac, Isaac, son of Abraham, Jacob's dad, represents the next step in the evolution of the Hebrew people. Isaac was the first born Hebrew. Purely by declaration was Abraham a Hebrew. But Isaac, his son, was a Hebrew by birthright. Yet even then, a declaration of God was still involved because Abraham had another son, Ishmael, whom Abraham considered to be his firstborn and therefore should be the one to carry on the covenants God had made with Abraham. In other words, as far as Abraham was concerned, Ishmael was a Hebrew. And in the strictest sense, Ishmael was a Hebrew until something changed. Does that mess with your head just a little bit? I hope it does. You see, a time came when Jehovah said to Abraham, "Not so fast, Abraham. Just like I divided you away from your father and brother, I'm going to divide Ishmael away from his father and brother." Ishmael was to be divided and separated away from his father Abraham and his brother Isaac. The effect is, Ishmael was not going to continue being Hebrew, but Isaac was. So here's the $64,000 question. And for you young people, that was a television program a long time ago. If Ishmael and Isaac both had a Hebrew father, only the one, Isaac, is today considered a Hebrew. Why isn't Ishmael just considered an alternate branch of the Hebrews? How come we don't think of Ishmael and all of his descendants, the ones that we today refer to as Arabs, instead as Hebrews too? An important principle gets established here that every Jew and Gentile needs to pay close attention to. So I ask you, give me all your attention, put this into that permanent part of your memory banks. While birthright, that is your genealogy, your physical bloodline, while that establishes your physical identity, family, your flesh and blood identity, it is the divine election and declaration of the Lord that establishes your spiritual identity. Your physical identity and your spiritual identity are two different matters, are they not?
Yes.
So the term Hebrew began by denoting much more than a simple physical and family identity. Hebrew also defined, most importantly, a spiritual identity. Let me put that together for you. By God's design, Hebrew was meant to be a term that described a combination of the physical and spiritual attributes of a person. Further, the life of a Hebrew, physically and spiritually, was to operate under a set of laws and promises that God made with that first Hebrew, Abraham. A Hebrew's earthly life was to revolve around his spiritual life. We call these laws and promises that define this overall life of a Hebrew the Abrahamic covenant. Later, they were expanded and given to Moses and are now called the Torah. So even though Isaac was physically of the right stock to be a Hebrew, it took an act of God, an election of God, for him to be declared a Hebrew. I want you to think about it. Ishmael was also physically of the right stock, at least from his father's side, to be a Hebrew. But God did not grant Ishmael the necessary spiritual status to be a Hebrew. Therefore, we have with the election of Isaac and the rejection of Ishmael an enormous fork in the spiritual road. One direction leads to the Hebrews and the covenant promise, the other away from the Hebrews and covenant promise. In Genesis 25, as we start to deal with Isaac's twin sons, Jacob and Esau, Yaakov and Esau, we're going to see this process and principle repeated yet again. The issue of who will be chosen as inheritor of the rights of the divine covenant given to Abraham is the crux of that. Put it another way. Between Jacob and Esau, God would declare his choice of which one would be Hebrew, the other would not. Both Jacob and Esau, by all physical evidence, were born from their Hebrew father, Isaac, and even the same physical mother, Rivka. They were, after all, fraternal twins. By birth, if one went purely by the physical definition, it would seem that they both ought to be Hebrews. And in a sense, they both were. But no, God would again, by declaration, divide, elect, and separate. Now let's go back to Isaac and Ishmael. Let's remember that while we could see some physical and genealogical differences between Isaac and Ishmael, after all, they had different mothers of different nationalities, and so they were half-brothers. It was entirely different for Jacob and Esau because they were, of course, had the same mother and father coming from the same womb. As twins, physically, genealogically, there was no difference between Jacob and Esau. Their DNA was almost identical. So how is it that Jacob was elected as a Hebrew? Esau was not. It was by declaration alone. It was God's sovereign decision. That's what the word election means. That God chose Jacob over Esau. Jacob would be a Hebrew. Esau was stripped of his right to be called Hebrew. The only difference between Jacob and Esau was the spiritual difference. And that was brought about purely by the declaration of Jehovah God. So to better help us define just what a Hebrew is, we can say that a Hebrew is one who has been made a descendant in the line of covenant promises that were given to Abraham. Or in Bible terminology, a Hebrew is an inheritor of the covenant promises given to Abraham. If a human being is an inheritor of the covenant promises, then that human being is part of God's set apart people. And thus the world was, upon God's covenant with Abraham, divided into two groups, Hebrews and all other human beings. Abraham established the line of covenant promise at the declaration of God. Even Abraham's father and brother were excluded from this. Abraham's son Isaac continued. He inherited the line of covenant promise at the declaration of God. Abraham's other son, Ishmael, was excluded. Isaac's son, Jacob, he would continue the line of covenant promise at the declaration of God. Isaac's other son, Esau, he would be excluded. Now, we can debate the fairness, the equity, even the reasons for God's choice. But that would be putting God on trial, so we're not going to do that here. Our only choice as believers is simply to accept his sovereign right to choose whatever he wants. But as we're going to see in a couple more chapters, from Jacob forward, all descendants of Jacob would be called Hebrew. No more exclusions. No more election by declaration. God. Beginning with Jacob's offspring, one would be Hebrew by law and by birthright. If one was physically born to a Hebrew, that person was a Hebrew, period. But even more, if one who was not born a Hebrew, that is, he or she was a Gentile, if that Gentile wanted to become part of the Hebrew people, it was allowed. By means of some rules and some obligations that have been set down by Jehovah God. I hope you're following me. I mean, because this applies to you, it applies to me, it applies to everybody that lives on this planet. All of what I've been explaining sets up the God-defined pattern of how anyone becomes part of God's people. That ought to matter to us. So, how one comes to be called part of God's people, his set apart people, the Hebrews who would eventually become called the Israelites, occurs by means of series of forks in the road. It started with the Abraham fork, then the Isaac fork, and then the Jacob fork. And it stayed that way for about 1,800 years. However, 18 centuries after Jacob, we're going to find another fork in the road. It's called the New Covenant Messiah. This newest fork in the road then brings us actually full circle. This fork brings to fruition that promise of the Abrahamic covenant that all the families of the earth would be blessed. All doesn't mean Gentiles and not Jews. All doesn't mean Jews and not Gentiles. All means all. And further, just who is included under the covenants of the Hebrews once again involves God's election and declaration. And the key to all this is the works and the person of Messiah. He's the key. So the story we're about to dissect here in Genesis chapter 25, the story of a crucial division, election, and separation by the God of Israel is one that has so many wonderful nuances, and it establishes so many non-negotiable messianic principles. Unfortunately, time's only going to permit us to explore a couple of them. So open your Bibles to Genesis chapter 25. We're going to start reading at verse 19. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, it'll be on page 25. Page 25, if you have a complete Jewish Bible, we're going to start at chapter 25 of Genesis, verse 19, and go to the end. Here is the story of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham fathered Isaac. Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rivkah, the daughter of Bethuel the Arami, the man from Aram, from Padan Aram, and sister of Laban the Arami, to be his wife. Isaac prayed to Adonai on behalf of his wife because she was childless. Adonai heeded his prayer, and Rivkah, Rebekah, became pregnant. The children fought with each other inside of her so much that she said, "If it's going to be like this, why go on living?" So she went to inquire of Adonai, who answered her, "There are two nations in your womb. From birth, they will be two rival peoples. One of these peoples will be stronger than the other, and the older will serve the younger." When the time for her delivery came, there were twins in her womb. The first to come out was reddish, covered all over with hair like a coat. So they named him Esav, completely formed, having hair already. Then his brother emerged with his hand holding Esau's heel, so he was called Yaakov, he who catches the heel, he who supplants. Isaac was 60 years old when his wife bore them. The boys grew. Esau became a skillful hunter and outdoorsman, and while Jacob was a quiet man who stayed in the tents. Isaac favored Esau because he had a taste for Cain. Rebekah favored Jacob. Now one day, when Jacob had cooked some stew, Esau came in from the open country exhausted. And he said to Jacob, "Please let me gulp down some of that red stuff. That red stuff, I'm exhausted." This is why he was called Edom, which means red. And Yaakov answered, "First sell me your rights," is the first one. "Look, I'm about to die," said Esau. "What use are my rights?" is the firstborn. Jacob said, "First swear to me." So he swore to him, thus selling his birthright to Jacob. Then Jacob gave him bread and lentil stew. He ate and drank, got up, went on his way. Thus Esau showed how little he valued his birthright. Rivkah, Rebecca, wife of Isaac, is worried. Her womb is absolutely in violent upheaval. What is going on in there? Whatever it is, it's not normal. These may have been her first children, but she had undoubtedly witnessed scores of pregnancies and assisted in not just a few births. That's part of what women did. So she seeks Jehovah for reassurance and to calm her fears, and God gives her his answer. "Well, here's the problem, Rebecca. There's two nations that are living within you, and what you are feeling is a struggle for dominance." Even more, he tells Rebekah that the first one out of the birth canal shall not be given the rights and honor as the firstborn, in Hebrew, the Bechor, which was customary. Rather, it would be the second one to emerge. This is a theme that is ongoing in the Bible, a theme that separates what seems to be, from a physical earthly sense, from what actually is, from a spiritual heavenly point of view. From a physical sense, it seemed to Abraham that Ishmael, the son of his concubine Hagar, was his firstborn son, the son of promise, because indeed he did come first, several years first. But from a spiritual sense, it was going to be Isaac, born later and miraculously by Sarah, who was to have all the firstborn rights and become the all-important son of promise. Now, here in Genesis chapter 25, we have a similar thing. Rivka is carrying twins. The law and the custom is that the first one to be born, that's the firstborn, the Bekor. And the second one to be born is more or less subservient to the first. The fact that a firstborn was a twin meant little. They don't divide the inheritance. They don't each get an equal share of the firstborn inheritance. One's chosen, the other's not. That's how it worked. And this violent struggle in Rivka's womb foretells this coming struggle over just which child is going to dominate the other one. Even more, we find that God has predetermined the outcome. Neither Isaac nor Rebecca are involved in that decision. In verse 23, Rivka is told, the older one will serve the younger. In other words, the physical firstborn will not receive the usual and customary rights of the Bekor. The firstborn, the second one, that one will receive that right. The eternal importance of this matter is that the physical firstborn, Esau, is not going to become the inheritor of the covenant promise. Instead, the physical secondborn, Jacob, he's going to be the inheritor. Jacob is the Bekor on a spiritual level. He is the firstborn based on God's divine election. Notice, the first physical firstborn of Isaac, who is Esau, is parallel to Ishmael, the physical firstborn of Abraham. The spiritual firstborn of Isaac, who will be Jacob, is the parallel to Isaac, the spiritual firstborn of Abraham and the future carrier of the covenant promises. So we have here this ongoing principle and a pattern of the reality of duality. Everything has a spiritual reality and a physical reality that exists simultaneously. But this much is also certain. These two separate nations, one being Jacob, the other one Esau, are going to have enmity for each other. This is part of the meaning of the phrase, the older shall serve the younger. The twins are born. The first one born was Esau. He was of red or ruddy complexion and very hairy. You know, a lovable little fuzzball. In Hebrew, the word is sear. Sear. No, it doesn't mean lovable little fuzzball. It just means hairy. Now, if that word rings a bell for you, it should, because we're going to find out later on in Genesis that Esau would move away from Jacob, establish his own nation in a district called Mount Seir. This is a wordplay. Mount Seir got its name from Esau being born Seir, hairy. So it's Mount Hairy, or Hairy Mountain. Now, we're also told that during the birth process, Jacob was holding on to Esau's heel. The idea being that Jacob was trying to keep Esau from being born first. Come back here, you little rascal. Now, to better help explain what comes next, we should here understand that Rebecca would not have kept this information that God gave to her about the destinies of her twin sons to herself. That would have been disloyal and disrespectful to her husband. Rather, she would have told him post-haste of what God had informed her, that whichever of the twins came out first was not to be declared the Bekor, the firstborn. Rather, it was the second to emerge. After all, there was little more important in a family in that era than who would succeed the father in authority over the claim, the successor being the Bekor, the firstborn. Even more, you can be sure Rebecca informed her twin sons, Esau and Jacob, of God's determination that Jacob and not Esau would be Bekor, firstborn. How cruel it would have been to have waited until their maturity to inform them of this important decree, a decree that mother and father were aware of before these children were born. So, it is with that understanding of the entire family's awareness of the younger Jacob being destined to have the birthright above the older Esau that we have to view what happens next. As the story unfolds, we find, as is common within families, parents have their favorites. Sorry, kids, it's true. Esau was apparently impetuous, and he was brave, and he was skillful, with a quite macho. Macho Esau. Things that dads typically admire in their sons. Jacob, he was quieter, he was introspective, he was kind of sensitive. Things that mothers typically prefer. Notice our parallel once again with Ishmael and Isaac. Ishmael, whose favorite was he? Abraham's. Isaac was a favorite with his mama. When Yehovah told Abraham that it was to be his secondborn, Isaac, that was to obtain the firstborn position currently held by Ishmael, Abraham cried out to God, we're told, "Oh, if only Ishmael could live in your presence." Abraham determined he wanted Ishmael to stay as the firstborn. Isaac determined he wanted Esau to be the firstborn. Neither one of them was going to get what they wanted. So we see that a day arrives when Esau has just come in from a hunt, famished. He sees that Jacob has prepared a pot of lentils, or more literally translated, red stew. Jacob, apparently never having been entirely comfortable with having the rights of the firstborn assigned to him, decides he's going to help God out a little bit. He's going to get Esau to openly and finally sell his traditional birthright to his brother Jacob. The impulsive Esau makes a statement in response to Jacob's proposal that begins with, "Well, since I'm about to die, he might as well give his birthright to Jacob," and he seals the deal with an oath. The "I'm about to die" statement, that's not literal. It's just a saying, that's something akin to saying, "Ah, who cares? Who cares?" Of course, since God had long ago settled the issue, in reality, Esau had no birthright to sell. It already belonged to Jacob. And Jacob had no need to resort to treachery to try to obtain the birthright because the Lord had already assigned it to him. But neither Jacob nor Esau had the faith to accept that fact. We're also given here a small piece of information that we'll find useful in the chapters ahead. Esau is given a nickname. Edom. Edom means red. And it not only refers to his ruddy, hairy body features, but also to this famous, I guess probably infamous, incident at the stew pot that has just transpired. So for future reference, remember, Edom and Esau are the same, are one and the same. And therefore, the future nature of nation of Edom, so prevalent from here on in the Bible as an ongoing enemy of Israel, will also play a role in the end times. And know that the people of Edom, Edomites, are simply the descendants of Esau. That's who they are. Well, finally, in verse 34, we're told that Esau despised his birthright. Now, this is a very serious biblical condemnation of Esau. I have little doubt that Rivka told Esau, as she undoubtedly did Jacob, that despite the chronological order of their birth, it was Jacob who was going to have the firstborn rights. What a hurtful thing that would have been for Esau. Can you imagine? Which would have made him bitter, untrusting, cynical. His father, Isaac, you see, Isaac wasn't a poor man. To think that Esau had no interest in having all the rights and powers of the firstborn, frankly, doesn't make any sense. He probably saw his losing of the firstborn rights as an inevitable, although grossly unfair, event. So, He behaved as though it didn't matter. I don't care. Kind of rejecting the office of firstborn before it was rejected for him. Folks, it can be hard. But these people we read about in the Bible were just that. They were people. Just people. They have feelings. They have wants and needs. They have quirks. They had shortcomings. They had pride. They had ambitions. They were real. When we better understand the circumstances, it's not too hard to put ourselves in their shoes. Okay, now let's back up a little bit. Take a look at some circumstances surrounding this event that aren't so evident, at least not so evident with Gentiles. First, anybody find it odd we had a male Jacob doing the cooking here when all the females are around? Clearly, the scriptures say Jacob cooked the stew. Now, cooking was a woman's task, particularly when they were camped or living in villages. Certainly, men who were away from home did some cooking. But it was traditional and would have been shameful under normal circumstances for a young man to be the one doing the cooking. Was Jacob a sissy? Had his mother's favoritism turned him into a real mama's boy? Where I'm going is, when we understand ancient Hebrew culture, much of which, by the way, has carried over into modern Hebrew traditions, when we run across biblical scenes like of Jacob and Esau and the stew, you can recognize that something out of the ordinary is going on here. It's not usual that Jacob, at least 15 years old by this time, would have been doing the cooking. It just wasn't done. So what's going on here? Well, the answer may well lie in one of those beautiful Hebrew traditions that is part of every observant Jewish family today. It's a tradition that goes back to time immemorial. It's called sitting Shiva. Sitting Shiva. It is part of the rites of mourning the dead. So what is this to do with our story? The ancient Hebrew sages are near unanimous that the context for what's playing out between Esau and Jacob is that there's been a death in the family, and that the one who died was Abraham. Lentil stew, or lentil soup, is called the meal of mourning. It's a tradition. Lentil soup is a traditional food that's eaten during the seven-day period of mourning of a loved one that's called sitting Shiva. I'll explain that a little bit more in a minute. So I want you to think about it. What's the point of the Holy Scripture going on and on about this being a red stew, then identifying it as lentils, specifically in verse 34? How does that add anything? How does that add anything at all to the context of the meaning? What difference does it make that the soup is lentil? Any good Jew knows that this is indicative of a mourning period. But there's more evidence. Those who are members of the immediate family are not to cook during that seven-day period of time. Other family members, friends, are to provide food for those 7 days. Or foods are prepared, cooked, preserved before the death of a family member, because it's imminent. Then they could be eaten. And the definition of just who makes up the immediate family is important. One's father and mother, sister and brother, son and daughter, or spouse, that's defined in the mourning rituals as an immediate family member. Grandchildren are not immediate family members for purposes of mourning rites. Rivka, who normally cooked for the family, would have been prohibited. Jacob, Abraham's grandchild, was permitted to cook because he was outside that circle of what was defined as immediate family for mourning purposes. So perhaps that's why it was he that was cooking the meal of mourning. Lentil stew. Why lentils? In fact, we also find that eggs are considered a food suitable for morning. Why these two foods, lentils and eggs? What do they have in common? They're round. And their roundness illustrates the idea of life being circular, the cycle of being conceived from nothing, returning to nothing, physically speaking, of course. And it also speaks of one generation dying off, the next beginning, in an unending pattern. It is the Bible, it's in the Bible, it's biblical, and naturally the Hebrew thought that comes from it, that shows us that history is circular. History repeats itself. Over and over we see the same patterns that God ordained, established, woven into the fabric of the universe, and then repeating. And naturally, it is secular humanism and its proud son, Darwinian evolutionism, that says, no. History is not circular, it's a straight line. It starts from some unknown place in the past and randomly proceeds to some unknowable future. There's no patterns. Morality evolves and it adapts. The old becomes obsolete, the new becomes preeminent. The old becomes replaced by something that destroys the prior pattern, and then it establishes a new pattern. That's secular humanism. The illustration of the lentil and the egg says otherwise. And boy, I like this tradition. We humans need physical illustrations of God's spiritual principles. We need to be able to see it. When we put them aside or we don't think we need them anymore, the result is deception and error. So it is probable that Abraham had just died, Jacob was preparing the meal of mourning, when Esau shows up from a hunt. He didn't come into some surprise that his grandfather Abraham had just died. He was well aware of it before he went out. Rather than be with the family and do his duty to be a mourner and a comforter to his father in particular, he did what pleased him. He was a hunter, so he went out and he hunted. It's no coincidence that when Jacob approached Esau with the offer to trade Esau's birthright for some of this lentil stew, Esau responded with the words, "Look, I'm about to die. What use are my rights of the decor?" That was at least in part kind of graveyard humor done at a kind of inappropriate time. Let's remember at this point, Esau was a mid to late teen, a very angry mid to late teen. So these weren't mature or well thought out words he was blurting out. They were impetuous and they were foolish. Yet it shows us just what he thought, at least at this point, about his exalted position as the Bekor of the firstborn, and the answer is not much. Look, when we talk about the rights of the firstborn, which includes getting a double portion of the family's wealth and the right to rule over the clan, it's easy to forget about the responsibilities that goes hand in hand with the rights and all that good stuff. Any straight-thinking parent knows what I'm talking about. Any executive or manager or leader knows what I'm talking about. Yes, there are rewards and honors that come with position, but there are duties that, if carried out properly, rise above any amount of reward and personal benefit. Esau knew his grandfather Abraham well. And he was equally aware of the great and terrible burden that he carried. Esau, of course, knew his father Isaac well, and the tremendous burden of responsibility for the covenants of God that he carried. Esau wanted no part of it. Without doubt, like many teens, Esau wanted all the fun stuff. Telling people what to do, but nobody telling him what to do. He He loved the idea of possessing the best place at the table, being wealthy, all that. But he did not want the responsibility and duty that went with it. The great sage Rashi says that another lesson of this incident is how a righteous person views life in general versus how a wicked person does the same. Jacob, the righteous one, his view of life is, what have I been put here to accomplish? What are my duties? What are my goals? The wicked one's viewpoint, Esau's view, is eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we may die. Esau was thinking, after contemplating the death of his grandfather, he didn't want to be tied to all these duties of a firstborn and family patriarch when his father Isaac died. No way. Hey man, I just want to enjoy life. I want to get as much as I can, all I can. Responsibilities for suckers. I recall more or less saying those words to my father when I was about 16 years old. I lived through it. Barely. Jacob chose that very moment to challenge his twin brother Esau, because no one knows another person better, perhaps, than one twin knows another. Jacob knew Esau was ready to give up his birthright and all these burdensome duties that came with it, and the death of his grandfather, and the thinking we all tend to do about our own lives when someone near to us dies, just kind of drove him over the edge. The divinely ordained duties that Isaac must have talked about, Abraham must have talked about incessantly, that was nothing Esau wanted. So great was the importance of carrying on with the line of covenant promise that nothing, he was told, could be put above that. Much was contained in verse 27 to inform us of the character of each of these two young men. It says, Esau became a hunter, Jacob was a quiet man who lived in tents. I'm not going to spend very long with this, but I'd like you to take note. Only in two places in the Holy Scriptures is an important Bible character called a hunter, or in Hebrew, a tzayid. A tzayid. The first man that was labeled as a hunter, used as a means of identifying his character, was Nimrod. The other one is Esau. The only two. A guy who kills animals for the love of killing and has little, if any, conscience in killing a man. Jacob, on the other hand, is called a quiet man. Some Bibles, a plain man, and others, a peaceful man. The Hebrew word that is being translated is tam, T-A-M, tam. While peaceful or plain isn't necessarily incorrect, it misses the point. Jacob and Esau are being contrasted. They are being compared as opposites. Tam more means blameless or not having any guilt. It is implied that this blamelessness is being blameless before God. That's the idea. It's another way of saying righteous, really. The contrast here is about one who loves killing versus one who loves life. One who wanders aimlessly versus one who stays near. One who slaughters the flock versus the one who shepherds the flock. The last verse sums up this entire episode, and I don't even think it requires a comment. It says, thus Esau showed how little he valued his birthright. Well, we'll stop for now and continue with Jacob and Esau next time.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning. Products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.